Welcome to the Connected Commute podcast from Bolden Networks. Bolden Networks is unlocking the power of an interconnected future by bringing you insights in transport from around the globe. I'm Ian Montgomery of Label Sessions, and today Chris Bichette from Bolden Networks is talking to Hayden Clarkin. Hayden, known as the Transit Guy on the internet, is a transportation guru and founder of the virtual summit TransitCon. From a childhood mesmerized by transit to a career of building change within it, Hayden truly lives up to what he's known for.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're here with Hayden Clarkin, the Transit Guy, I understand.
So aptly named.
I think I've also seen you referred to as the Transit King.
So it's very funny, actually. The Transit King is my personal Instagram that I use to differentiate the Transit Guy and the Transit King. I didn't really know what to call myself personally, and I didn't want to just be like Hayden Clarkin as like a boring personal Instagram. So I have the differentiation, which makes my family very, very confused because they'll keep tagging me in like wedding photos as the Transit Guy. And so all like 30 something thousand followers of me get to see like photos of me at a wedding.
Did this happen because your friends just got tired? Oh, it's that Transit Guy again.
Actually, so I used to work for a very large engineering firm in San Jose, California. And I was really one of the only people who really had a huge passion about transit while working there. And so people would go, oh, that's Hayden. He's our transit guy at the office. And so it just kind of stuck. And obviously there are a lot of people who know a lot more about transit than myself. But I just kind of named myself that as like a joke on Twitter, and it kind of stuck. And then someone said, hey, are you the transit guy once while I was walking down the street in New York City? And I was like, oh, I'm going to say kind of stuck. So if you like the transit guy, it's me. If you don't, it's someone else.
you know you've got a maid when you get spotted in the street.
Yeah, it was really funny. It was very funny. Thank God I was not in a car or anything.
So tell us how you got there. I understand you grew up around buses. You're a bit of a train spotter as well.
Yeah. So I grew up, and honestly, like looking back, it's so obvious that I liked trains and transit, but I kind of didn't see it when I was younger. So I grew up with a great uncle and my grandfather, who are brothers, loving transit. My grandfather was a bus driver for Rhode Island Public Transit Authority, which is the only statewide transit authority in Rhode Island. And so I used to get to go on some of his buses. They had a bunch of the old heritage trolleys, which were really cool. It was basically just like a normal bus that had like wood paneling on the side, but I thought it was like the coolest thing ever. And so I used to do that and really enjoyed it. And then when my grandfather didn't know what to do with me as a single man who didn't know what to do with his like new grandson, he would take me to the MBTA transit station / Amtrak station in Providence. We used to watch the trains go in and out, and I loved it. And then everyone, all my great uncles kind of caught on. I had a model railroad around my bedroom as a kid. So if you turned on the little switch that my great uncle had, it would go all the way around, kind of like where crown molding is. Love that. And then we used to go to model train sets in like random old factories where like a bunch of old guys were like manning this like massive model railroad. And I was just absolutely in heaven. Loved it. And then I decided, oh, I'm going to do civil engineering. I always kind of knew I wanted to, but it was more building focused. And then my first year of college, I ran into a transportation professor who actually really wasn't just about highways, but was really about like transit and moving people versus cars. And it just like rekindled my love. Everything came back for it. And so I've kind of just taken that path.
And so where is that taking you from there? Where are you now?
I currently live in New York City. I have my own firm, the Transit Guy LLC, and I help a bunch of startups, a bunch of other firms in logistics, and I help with transit agencies on a myriad of problems that they're dealing with. And mostly it's now taken me into kind of the product user experience realm, which I find to be a lot more rewarding than what I was doing in transportation engineering. Before this job, I was working for 4 years in the actual major infrastructure space, working on actual pretty large rail projects, and I really liked it, but I didn't get to really talk much or dictate kind of any sort of the design. And it was a little bit of like, hey, we're doing this, even if it's not the best idea, like shut up and just CAD. And I didn't love that. It just didn't feel so fulfilling to me. And so then I think everyone went through this like existential crisis during COVID, where we were like, well, what do I want to be? What do I want to do? When I get on the other side of this, I want to do something different. And so while I was working as an engineer, I started tweeting about transit and how cool transit was, given the face of like transit completely collapsing during COVID. And it really caught on to this niche on Twitter. And it went from, I don't know, having 3,000 followers prior to tweeting about transit to now about, I think it's 100 and I think like 20,000 people. And then, you know, 40,000 on Instagram and other sites. So really, really enjoying it and really loving this space. And as I've said before to people, I'm just honestly trying to train pill people. I just want, you know, like trains, you know, there's advocacy that comes along with it. That's awesome. But a lot of where we're at is because of political will not being there. And so if I can show you what a country with great trains and buses and everything else looks like, I'll be that guy.
I think we're gonna go on to talk a lot about transit in America and how we do things here versus other parts of the world. But it seems to me that you know, New York, particularly Manhattan, is not the epicenter of the problem. It seems to me New York has got a critical mass where it makes sense for a lot of people, not just the destitute, which is a perception of transit, but where it makes sense to not drive your car and you can get around adequately on transit. So it's got that critical mass of infrastructure to make it worthwhile, like London. You know, it's easier to take transit. There are a lot of other places in America that I would argue need your help more.
One thing I'll say about that is like, there are, people don't realize this, but Boston and Atlanta and Los Angeles have some of the worst traffic delay. I think in Boston in the last couple of years, they've measured that people are sitting in their cars for 7 days straight, like in total a year. That's actually crazy to think about. That's like really wild. If I was like, hey, Chris, would you mind just sitting in your car in the driveway for 7 days straight? You'd be like, am I crazy? And like, but we're doing this all the time. So New York City just really has a great legacy system that it's able to build off of, as well as just having the density there. And, you know, the Jane Jacobs who stopped Robert Moses from just completely decimating the city into some sort of like post-war sprawl that we've seen. So the bones in New York City are great. And one thing I want to mention is when you are in the New York City subway, for instance, the amount of like diversity of race and groups and backgrounds and cultures and wealth on the subway is like very, very stark, just to see a myriad of people all on the 7 train, all on the F train, all on the 1 train, all going to the same place. And the reason people are doing that is because it's the fastest way to get around the city, right? And like, that's the thing that people need to realize is that it's the fastest way to get around. And so obviously if you're going uptown from downtown, you're not going to sit in a car for 30 blocks. You're going to take the 6 train. And that's just been ingrained, whether you're on the Upper West Side, whether you're in Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx, wherever. It's beautiful to see. And that's why I think transit works so well in New York City, is it's not seen as some sort of perception of like, oh, well, I own a car, so why would I take the subway? It's like, well, if you live in Long Island, you're going to want to take the train into work every day because the congestion is so bad. So that's what really gets me excited about. And we could talk a little bit more about the future of transit in America. And I think that's a really good recipe for it.
Yeah. And that was kind of my point, is it's got this critical mass of transit that makes it easier, makes it worth your while to take transit as opposed to driving in. But elsewhere in North America, there's a perception that the car is freedom above everything else, above the convenience, above whatever. It's freedom. And you'll take my car away from my cold, dead hands. And
seriously,
well, perhaps, but, you know, we'll talk about the transit difficulties a lot of places have, but I think in North America, a lot of it nets down to the perception of transit.
Absolutely.
That the problems are very long-term to solve in our view.
Yeah. And I also, I would push back a little bit in saying, I think it's not the perception of like what transit is, but more like the perception of what transit can be. A lot of times policymakers look at transit as like, oh, you don't own a car and you have like a lower socioeconomic, you know, status.
It's for people who can't afford to drive.
We have a bus that comes every hour and like we checked off that box and it's like, why are we not thinking of transit as like an actual alternative to cars, not to alternative to people who just can't afford a car? And when you kind of change that dichotomy of like, no, I want transit to actually be time competitive with a car, you actually are able to change like the entire recipe for how transit can work. One year in college, I studied at the University of Stuttgart in Germany. It's a public transportation, as a public transportation academia and curriculum. And every day I would take the train to downtown from campus. And there was always this woman who sat in the same train car. I was like, always was like admiring her. She had a fur coat on and she had Louis Vuitton, I don't know, I think they're like $800 shoes. And she wore them all the time. And I was like, what is this woman? She's got a fur coat. What is she doing on the S-Bahn in Stuttgart? And one day I just like went up to talk to her and she's like, oh, it's just the fastest way into the city. Like looking at me like I was a weirdo for even asking. She's like, it's just the fastest way to get here. And I'm like, oh, right. Because like when it's convenient over the car, everyone will take it. And we're not looking at it as some sort of like, you know, like welfare, like arm of like our social welfare.
And it is a very... A very geographic difference. I'll call it geographic. There are underlying issues behind it, of course, but North America doesn't treat things the same way as Europe does when it comes to transit. Since we've got started on this project, this all started off with envisioning the station of the future, and we've gone pretty deep into transit. And in that, we've discovered two things that I hold true. One is we've built our cities wrong, and two, we suck at transit, and I can't help but think it's a perceptual thing where, you know, outside of the masses, the New York City, where you have that critical mass of infrastructure, everybody else sees transit as what you do when you can't afford a car. So how do we, you know, it's going to take some brave political decisions. How do we steer the Titanic away from the iceberg and try and get more public perception willing to back transit? I'm asking you the several billion dollar question, but
it's a really good question. Like with New York, it obviously was like it's cultural to take the subway just because it makes sense and it's been there in its entire form that we see today since the 40s.
I just don't think you can jam any more roads into Manhattan.
Right. Totally. And I would push back again on your framing. I think we did build our cities right. I think we slowly destroyed them. But we originally built them right? Like we've always seen this kind of like before and after highway like photos that are just like the most devastating urban sprawl, you know, urban redevelopment. And a lot of that changed the equation of just how we moved, right? We had in post-war, we had the GI Bill, which gave everyone who came home from war money to go to the suburbs. They're those cool suburbs. Like, get out of the city. Everyone had money subsidized to go do that. And then obviously the addition of white flight didn't help. And it really hollowed out these kind of like beautiful urban centers we had. And then why would we need transit? We have these unbelievable highways that Eisenhower just helped us build. Why would we take that? And now we found ourselves so far away from what we used to be that we don't realize that Kansas City used to have 200 trains leave its center station every single day. 200 more trains every single day. That's more than European cities today have. And we like got away from that. And for a while, we had the Amtrak replacement for that station was a small outhouse, I'd call it, under a highway interchange. And so like you make that cultural change. And so how do we reverse that? And that's been a slow but surely change. And I think one thing I would say is, you know, we see the success of routes like Brightline in Florida. We've seen the success of the Kansas City streetcar in front of that station that used to have 200 trains per day. And we're slowly seeing more of a desire for that. And that's really exciting for me to see as a transit advocate of, okay, maybe we just have to prove again and start from the beginning about how great like transit can be when it works for everyone and like when it actually has priority. And so I'm hoping we're starting this transit renaissance in a lot of areas, but you know, Amtrak had its highest ridership year this year since it was created in 1971. So there is some zhuzh, for lack of a better word, to come back, and I'm hoping that the renaissance is going to start soon.
I stand corrected. I agree with your assessment. The cities were built right.
Oh, you're good.
And then we blew it. And I read one of your posts that said, you know, you're obviously a massive transit advocate, but you showed the time lapse over time of the rail lines across America and how they were magnificent 60, 80 years ago. And you said, all we're trying to do is recover what we had. And I think that's a brilliant take on the problem, because 60 years ago, transit on trains across America was magnificent. The country was built on it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd have to do like an analysis on every route, because there's obviously so many routes that we've lost. But a majority of train travel today is slower than it was 50, 60 years ago. And I always tell people, you know, slow trains that come once a day are not a barometer for fast and frequent trains that come once an hour. So I don't understand, you know, I don't think Apple has ever looked and said like, oh, the iPhone 3 doesn't have a lot of demand in 2023. We're not going to put out another iPhone. Like, I don't think that's the way it works. And it's like, we're using 60 plus year old technology and pretending that like, oh, well, people don't want slow trains. I guess if they don't want fast ones. It's like, I don't understand the logic in that at all. I just don't get it.
I'm going to come back to the perception thing again. Your advocacy for transit must provoke some eye rolls.
Oh, a lot.
Because I feel like there's a segment of the population that just doesn't want to talk about this. I describe myself, I'm not a transit advocate. I'm not a train lover. I'm not, I am a cyclist, but I don't consider myself pushing cycling. But we've done all this work, and I just want what makes sense. It's common sense. But being a stark advocate, I just feel like there's a knee-jerk reaction that comes from so many, you know, a segment of the population, say. And how can we convince them? You know, one of the lines I use is, better transit means you have more room to drive your car.
That's exactly.
Driving is better. Yeah.
Right. Totally. I hate oysters so much. I'm sorry for the people who love oysters. And I come from New England, so I know that's like a sacrilege. I hate oysters. I've never gone into a restaurant once in my life and been like, take the oysters off the menu. I don't want to eat them. If you are happy, because I hear this all the time from people on Twitter. Oh, well, how are you going to want me to get out of my BMW? And I'm like, well, because you tell me you have a BMW, clearly you want that car as a status. Stay in the car. But like, maybe some of those brake lights in front of you might want a fast train that can get them to work. And I don't see how that's like not a benefit for you, like everybody. So I think about that a lot, where it's like, even if you never want to step in transit for whatever personal reason you believe in, I just don't understand why you don't want to afford that other option to other people. Because we've tried this experiment over the last 60 years of one more lane will fix it, one more lane will fix it. And like, look at Toronto. It's not that big of a city compared to like Tokyo. And like, Tokyo has no highways that are as wide as it. So what does that say? Right.
So many lanes and one of the worst commutes in North America.
Correct. It's like, okay, is the next lane going to do it? I guess. I mean, at what point do we say like, maybe we should build rail, maybe we should build bus priority, and you know, people who want to take that can take it, and hopefully it lessens the brake lights in front of me. And so I always kind of push back on this idea of like, well, I don't want it. It's like, okay, well, I don't, then don't use it. But other people might be willing to. And honestly, as someone who's like ridden Southwest recently, I don't know why anybody wants to be on planes all the time for the littlest travel. So I don't get it. So, it just drives me crazy. So I hope while we go into the holiday season and people look around the airports and go, is this the best we can get? Is this the best there is? You know, I hope people look at it differently.
So those people who aren't necessarily hardcore on the other end of the spectrum, how do we encourage them to explore their transit options? How do we encourage them to go to Amtrak and you know, voice their opinions about how to make Amtrak better and lay some pressure on How do we get more ridership in the places we need more ridership?
Great question. So if you are looking at your local, and I understand, so like, I understand that I think it's 90 to 95%. It depends on the year, but 90 to 95%, and someone can correct, I'm sure one of your listeners will correct me, but like 90 to 95% of transit ridership in America is New York City region. And 99% of transit in New York is ridden in New York City. So the numbers are stark. I understand the landscape in a lot of areas for transit aren't great. And where they are good but have died, unfortunately, since COVID or have seen severe or are facing severe cuts, I would tell people to talk to their local leaders, talk to their local councilmen. It's amazing what shame will do. And I understand politicians, you know, don't always respond to shame. But, you know, we've seen in the Bay Area in California where BART was facing a huge windfall. There was so much outcry to the assembly members and to the congressmen that that the state went in and actually created more funding for BART so that it literally did not lay off almost its entire staff. So I would argue that we can improve transit if people are willing to kind of put in the work. And I think that's kind of been the hard part of people just kind of being complacent and being like, oh, well, we're car culture, you know, we're car dependent. Everyone gets around with the car. And it is a chicken or the egg. And there are enough transit advocates in every city, I would say, at least every major city, who are willing to put in that work. And so every organization, I know of tons of organizations in every kind of major city who are working on trying to create better transit. And working on making that better transit that you want to ride. If you are not happy with the transit you are riding today, I do not blame you. I do not blame you at all. Drive a car if you need to. Don't try and make a point if it's like too hard for you to get around. But at the same time, we need to hold our political leaders accountable while they spend the most money that they've ever spent in modern era on highways. They're still doing that today. We literally spent tens of billions of dollars in President Biden's infrastructure bill. So we're still doing it today. So it's like, if we get more than a remaining error, we could actually make a lot of difference. And that's pressure, unfortunately. That's just how it works.
And he just announced $3 billion in the Brightline project between Los Angeles and Las Vegas.
Yes. And another project I'm very excited for, once that kicks off and people who are in LA and people who are in Las Vegas, they don't have to fly anymore. They can take a train that takes them over 2 hours. Maybe there's more consensus for, hey, I want this here. Hey, I want this between St. Louis and Chicago. I want this between Chicago and Minneapolis. I want this between New York and Boston, or New York and Hartford, or New York and Montreal. Once we start seeing that consensus, I'm hoping that's what Brightline is going to be able to bring to American electorate.
And it'll be the party train. I think that'll be highly trafficked, that train.
What stays on the train?
What happens on the train stays on the train. Yeah.
Exactly.
This podcast is brought to you by Bolden Networks, unlocking the power of an interconnected future. We're delivering the advanced shared network infrastructures needed for a smart, inclusive, and sustainable future. From interconnected transit to venues, enterprises to smart cities, we're creating new possibilities in the way people live, work, and play. To find out more, visit bolden.com.
So are there service elements that you think should be a part of this? Like, you know, we can't just have, you know, some rickety old rust buckets rolling up and call that transit and encourage everybody to do that. We watched a podcast the other day where the host was talking to one of our heroes, Rory Sutherland. And the host just said, all we want is good Wi-Fi. Which is great for us. I wanted to get that guy on our podcast because Wi-Fi happens to be a good thing we do. But, you know, you need safety and security, we've decided. That's the baseline of the Maslow's hierarchy, because if it's not safe, you're only going to get people who absolutely need to use it. So assuming we can figure that out, what other services are important?
Great question. I would say that Wi-Fi is a little gadgety, and I know that sounds like kind of punny because it is a gadget. I think people don't realize the transformative change that fast, frequent, reliable transit can do. A bus that comes every 10 minutes is much better than a bus that comes every 30 minutes with Wi-Fi. And right now, the equation has been, well, let's try and get people, you know, buy different services, buy kind of like buy Wi-Fi. There's been other things of like, oh, well, maybe we have more digital screens inside, so maybe it'll attract more people. I'm not against any of those things, in especially like when it comes to commuter rail. I understand the need for it. I had to buy a mobile hotspot every time I rode Caltrain every day for an hour. So I totally understand where people want it. We are post-COVID facing ridership lows that we haven't seen in a while because frequency hasn't come back and service hasn't come back in a really substantial way. And people will respond to that more. And we've seen, I think there was a survey, I'm trying to remember if it was New York or San Francisco, where people were like, how can we get you back? And Wi-Fi and a few other kind of like added services were on there. And the number one was still frequency. And having frequent service and fast service that gets you there quicker or as quick as a car will do wonders, because you won't have to sit too long on a train. If the train's fast, you don't have to worry about why. You'll be there in a jiff.
But then you run into these cyclical problems where ridership is down. So funding is down because most public transit agencies in North America are heavily dependent on the fare revenue. So the transit agencies respond by cutting service, which makes it less desirable. You know, how do you break out of that cycle? I think that's...
Chris, you have gotten to the conundrum of transit in America at the moment. That is the problem that we are dealing with, is people are not responding to fast. People are not responding to the services at the moment because they have been so cut. Like, perfect example is Chicago. Chicago has seen a ridiculous sum of its service cut and not restored yet, and it's down historic lows in ridership. I wonder why, because people aren't going to respond to that when they're used to service that was even, you know, better before the pandemic. And so that's kind of really where we've been looking for the federal government and state and local governments to kind of fill that gap so that we can, you know, get to a place where we have more of a reliable funding stream, so more people then ride it again, so we can deal with that ridership equation. There have been kind of two thoughts with transit agencies as of late, as we come out of COVID. We have all this money from the federal government because of COVID that kind of like helped as a stopgap during lockdown. A good amount of transit agencies actually said, well, let's just use a little bit of that money at a time and we'll cut service so that we can keep the service consistent. And then there have been other transit agencies that have decided, let's run the best service we can with that money and hope that riders come back and, you know, politicians love it to the point where if the idea that we run out of this money happens, they're going to want to fill that gap. And WMATA in D.C. took that risk. Right now, they're facing a $750 million shortfall. I do think that gap will be filled, but they are running some of the best service they've ever run, ever. It's just, you know, ridership and D.C. has not come back yet with respect to the commutes that they've seen before. One interesting thing I will say, Chris, is that while the 9-to-5 model in transit is almost completely dead when it comes to transit in America, we have seen a huge pre-pandemic surge. More people are riding transit on the weekends and at night than they did previously to COVID. That's very big in New York City. It's been very big in BART in San Francisco. And it's been really nice to see that people are like, hey, I don't need to use a 9-to-5, but I can use it at 5 o'clock on a Saturday now. And to see that kind of ridership even out so that we're not dealing with like our normal peaks planning that we're doing has actually been really, really nice to see.
It's a huge benefit to smooth those curves.
Correct. So instead of, you know, trains coming every hour off peak, you know, and every 10 minutes on peak, how about we do like 20 minutes all day, right? Like, how about we like smooth that kind of peak and curve? And that's what's been happening, or at least been proposed in a lot of places. And that's really exciting to see, of like 20 minutes all day, every day, you know, until we close, versus, you know, 5 minutes at 5 o'clock and, you know, an hour or 2 hours at 10 p.m., you know, So kind of just evening that gap has been really exciting.
There's some more active options, we'll call them, that some places are implementing. Manhattan looks like they're going to introduce a congestion fee for drivers. That will certainly incent people to take transit a little more.
Yes, it will. And we're excited for that. The money that we are going to be, to be clear, it is going into Manhattan, but it is only a portion of the densest part of Manhattan. So if anyone who knows Manhattan,
below Central Park.
Yes, correct. Below Central Park. That is kind of the biggest job center. I don't know if, I think it might be in North America. I don't know. It's just so many jobs are in Midtown and in Lower Manhattan. And so that will be a congestion pricing. It's been a long, hard-fought battle that we've been dealing with. But knowing that money is going to go to be putting in better service and more capital planning for the MTA so that we have better transit is something I'm really excited about. And, you know, I believe that, like, people don't believe that we should have a rail line going down every single street in America. I also don't believe that private single occupancy vehicles with one or two people in them should be, you know, taking up a lot of space in the densest place in North America. I understand it's controversial and people have a lot of feelings on it, but that's just kind of my belief is you shouldn't be able to have to take up all of the space of the public right of way. So,
It's a brave decision. It's a politician making a brave decision
And we'll see how it works. It'll be an experiment. We'll see how it works.
And we'll see how others respond. I want to shift gears a little bit. I read something online that you had worked to design a station.
Yeah, I've worked on a bunch of stations.
Inside and out?
Yeah, so I worked on a project where, and I won't be specific, but I will be off the podcast. I worked on a pretty substantial project in California, where we worked on the space planning of kind of where everything was going to go, with a really cool, unique problem that we had. Oh, I think it must have been 6 or 7 rail agencies, transit agencies, operating out of this one station, all with different configurations that are necessary. Some were of long train sets, some were subway cars. Some were buses, some were just small bi-level commuter rail, just kind of like a whole cacophony of different station needs, and like putting all of those together, and every transit agency didn't want to work together as well as we had hoped that they would. But I think what we came up with and the framework that we came up with was really exciting and really fun. I'll say, when we're talking about like what a good station is, obviously, a good station is clean. Obviously, one thing that is huge that I'd love to talk a little bit more about is like another station with a great rider experience and information experience. Rider information is like paramount, and we're not paying enough attention to it. So really great, clean, consistent wayfinding is really important, as well as easy transfers. If I'm transferring at this station, I want to cross at the platform with the timed connection. Those are really kind of the big ones. And then access. Access is huge. If I want to ride my bike, if I want to ride my scooter, if I want to take a bus, if I want to take a regional bus, if I want to walk, or if I, you know, have a mobility issue and I want, you know, I'm in a wheelchair or in some sort of assistive device, like, what does that look like? And that is like a really fun problem to solve, but that's kind of like the main recipe you need, outside of like obviously great service that serves the trip, but like that's really exciting. And then the last thing I'd say too is like, when you are designing a new station or a station that's already existing, what does like 100 years look like from now? You know, because like the shelf life of a station is at least 50 years. You know, I mean, obviously you could put a facelift to it, but the actual like bones of the station really aren't changing too much, at least in North America. So what does it look like in 50 years from now? Like, what will this look like? Will we have flying cars? Like, will we even have trains? Will there be something completely different? What does that look like? And that is a really hard problem. Like, that to me is the most challenging, but it is really fun.
So in your travels around, you must have gotten some ideas, gleaned some good thoughts from what you've seen that were positive elsewhere, and that you wish you could adopt back home and you incorporate it into design, technology perhaps, or you've mentioned wayfinding. That's a topic that repeatedly comes up with us. It's one of my big pet peeves, how signs orphan you. They take you to this corner and this corner and then disappear. And so, you know, what did you glean from elsewhere that you wish you had more of in America?
So there, I'll say outside of just, let's pretend that, like, let's just take service being great in a lot of areas. I mean, obviously Europe can have better service in a lot of places, but let's just take that off the table for a second. One innovative technology that I think is, like, so cool and I want to see everywhere is around the topic of fare integration and how to pay for fares. This is always a very, very, very sticky problem that transit agencies deal with, that just mobility providers, inner city coach operators deal with, is like, how do we make it as easy as possible for you to pay? That's why I think Omni in New York, I'm not sure if you've used it. Omni in New York is Apple Pay. You literally click the little lock screen on the side opens. You're in within a second. You didn't swipe anything. There's no friction. You didn't touch anything. I think that's an awesome system. But one thing that SBB in Switzerland does that I think is amazing is they have the entire country basically coordinated with an SBB, their transit operator, and they are lucky enough to have one kind of statewide transit operator that runs through the entire country. I don't know why I said statewide, countrywide operator. You are able to, with this feature called Easy Ride, click start at wherever you're starting, and then get on the train, take a bus, take another train, take a bus, take a gondola, take whatever, take an elephant. And when you get to your destination and you click end, it knows exactly where you went and it debits your account for that ticket. So you don't have to buy any ticket beforehand of like, I'm going to be doing this, I'm going to be doing that. You see a bus that's quicker than the train you were going to take, you get on that bus. You see a train that was quicker than the other train you were going to take, you take that train. And because of that, it's able to geolocate based on your iPhone where you were and what train you were on. And it can give you an itinerary of, you took the 2 train here, you took the 47 bus here, you took the SBB train to, you know, Interlaken or whatever, and it's able to tell you exactly. And I think that's, like, the coolest technology. I don't think it would ever be able to be something that we could have in the States, given our data privacy laws with respect to transit agencies. But I do think it's a really, really cool technology that I'm excited to talk about.
I think there's a segment of the population in North America that thinks it's Bill Gates trying to get into your brain too.
And that's been a big problem, actually. I don't know exactly how it is in Canada, but due to a lack of distrust of the government, it is very difficult for people to, like, accept cookies or any sort of, like, data location in, like, with transit agencies. And so transit agencies peddle a line that's like, they try to peddle a line, like, so that doesn't happen. But because of that, you would never be able to get, like, where's your real-time location at all times? That probably wouldn't go over too well with a lot of people, even though it would be super convenient. And then one last thing I would say too is, at major bus stops and in bus stops that kind of serve the smallest, you know, town, group of houses in Switzerland that are, like, served by a bus or a train, there's always a, like, digital interface in the bus stops that tell you when the next bus is coming, like a departure board. And also with that, they have a map of, like, what those buses look like where is those buses taking you? Because I always think about, like, I love talking about the digital experience, and I love talking about, like, you know, all these great apps you could have on your phone. But, like, what if you're drunk and you're just at the club and you just, like, need to get home and you're in a city you've never been to? Like, or you just don't have a phone. You know, I know people who, like, just don't have smartphones. So, like, if you just stood at a bus stop, how would you know where that bus is taking you? How do you even know if the bus is coming? That's a really interesting problem. And a lot of times some of this, like, digital interface and signage that is, like, inside the bus stops that you can press a button and it says it for you if you have a mobility issues or you're blind. It's really, really cool. And I would love to see that technology more. We do have it in a lot of major transit agencies in America. We just don't have enough of it outside of, like, the main core. And I think it should be kind of standard to start seeing that everywhere when we talk about good bus stops and good transit and train stops.
You mentioned you don't really know where you're going. And we think that is probably the biggest underserved population in transit for passengers is people who are new to the system, people who are new to the country, people who are visitors from somewhere else who are using the transit system for the first time, and they come in and they have no clue where to go. And we just completely underserve them.
Totally. And we're like, hey, you have to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. We saw in Amsterdam, the Wi-Fi experience on the trackside, you open up, you connect to it, and you open it up, and it gives you information about here's everything that's leaving here today, and here's everything that's around here in the neighborhood. So great information for departing passengers and arriving passengers to that station. And you don't even have to connect to the internet. We thought that was brilliant. That was a brilliant application of technology.
It is really cool. And like one thing that like, you know, even we were talking about a little bit of like, why do people want transit if they wouldn't ride transit? And like, I always think of like any person who's like coming internationally to America. And I'm thinking about like the World Cup or the Olympics, and they land at any airport in America or in North America. And you say, where's the train? And we're like, oh, we don't have a train. We don't have a train. Like, hey, I know the Atlanta airport is like eons bigger than Frankfurt, and Frankfurt has about 25 different long distance routes that come every half hour. Yeah, the rental car is down the street, or the bus that comes once an hour is coming in another 50 minutes. Like, just that embarrassment to me is just like, well, why are we like this when we're the biggest economy on the planet? So yeah, I agree with you. Like, it's very difficult. And one thing that I think is a big hindrance to progress, which I know you want to talk a little bit about, was like how bifurcated transit agencies are. There are so many transit agencies in so many major metro areas that are either duplicative, serve the same geography, and they don't talk to each other. You know, the Bay Area is a perfect example. SFO is like one of the nicest airports, I think, in the world. You get there and you can use BART, but you don't know that it's served by three other bus agencies. Sorry, BART's not a bus agency, but like served by three bus agencies. Like, that's a thing. Nobody knows that. Because they don't, no agency speaks to each other. And in the Bay Area, you have 9 counties of 9 million people, and there are 27 transit agencies. And none of them tell you that where the other bus is, or, hey, you could get to BART. You know, you can get to, I always tell people when I'm in San Francisco, like, oh, have you ever been to Napa? Like, Napa Valley is gorgeous. Like, you love grapes, sit there, go to the vineyard or whatever. And people are like, oh, well, BART doesn't take you there. And I'm like, yes, but the bus does. There's actually like a wine bus, and it takes you straight from the BART stop. And BART doesn't tell people that, and nor does the bus tell people that. So you kind of have this like issue, and now you've lost a customer who would have taken that, or, you know, a less car on the road if we were able to tell people where people can go. And that's why I kind of like Switzerland with one major transit agency of like being able to connect all those dots for people.
Switzerland also has the benefit that they're not crossing state lines. Politics right. May differ from one state
Correct.
To another.
Yes.
Yeah. All the more credit to Brightline for going from California to Nevada.
It's very, very, very excited. I'm very excited to see that project happen. And one thing too, also I want to bring up, I don't want to speak for Brightline. I don't know anyone who works at Brightline, but a lot of countries like Japan, for instance, you know, like the Japanese bullet trains are operated by JR Railways, which is technically a quasi-private company. It is basically private and it is for profit. However, most of the money it makes is not from the trains. It's made from the real estate surrounding the train stations, which is a really, really important point. It's something that we've completely stripped from transit agencies in America, and value capture is really big as a big help when it comes to the financial success of a transit agency. And so for your listeners who don't know what value capture is, if you have a subway line that ends at a field at the end of a city, and you know the city has too many people or is overcrowded and there's no more room for housing, you can just keep building through that field and having the subway line extend. And you know, if you are the landlord or if you are the developer, you're able to sell or, you know, rent that land. And as a result, you're also serving you also pay for the actual services and the capital project. to actually see that through. So that's what value capture is called, as well as increasing a tax base so that it can then come back to you if you're a municipality. So yeah, those are some things that like Japan does. And I think Brightline, I don't know for sure, but like I would be shocked if Brightline had that space on the strip and did not build like a resort or a casino. I would be shocked, but maybe they do.
It's one thing we've noticed in our station's research is that the most successful places tend to be the ones that have stations that are community hubs that happen to have a train pass through them. And but there are places like throughout the UK, for example, where the stations are not operated by the transit operator at all. And they have little say in what happens in those and little benefit from making them successful.
Absolutely.
And that sounds like another long-term problem that's very difficult to reconcile.
Absolutely. And honestly, people don't realize this either. Land use is a huge, huge, huge indicator of how transit will work. You know, if I told you, Chris, let's build a subway in the middle of a farm, you'd probably be like, I don't know why we would do that because like nobody would ride it. And you're like, yes, correct. So we agree that what is surrounding a station is also like why people will go either from or to that station. And a lot of times when we're expanding, and I know this is true for Canada and America specifically, like when we are expanding or building new rail lines, we basically build them around freight rail railways. And because it's the easiest, right? Like we don't have to deal with like a community who's going to yell at us for like building a rail line in their, you know, in their community. But also Christoph Spietler, who wrote the Atlas of Transit, He came up with a great quote that I use all the time, is that like, if people are not outraged about the rail line you're building in their community, then you're not building it right. Because like we're building it where people are going. And, you know, Denver built out this huge, wonderful rail network with the RTD. It's a great suburban rail network. However, it really does not serve any of the communities. It basically just happens to go around each one on the periphery. And you have to like do a lot of walking or drive or take a bus, so that it's like, well, what's the point if I got to get on my car? But they did that because it was the most politically expedient and easiest way to acquire a right of way. And freight rail right of ways were built in order to like circumvent cities as a point. So like, why are we using those? So that's just like another point.
And that's the problem in Canada, is our passenger trains are largely pass on freight rails, and they have to give way to the freight traffic.
Huge problem.
If the passenger train falls behind schedule, now you've got to stop for a freight train, and it snowballs because you keep on getting interfered by other trains because you're out of sync. You're out of schedule for 5 minutes.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. The freight class one railroads that Canada largely deals with are the same ones that America largely deals with, and they are not fans of passenger rail at all. They don't want it encroaching or having to use any sort of shared track rights. And the priority has been a real problem when it comes to expansion. You know, Joe Biden and his administration have like announced, I think 40 plus new routes that they're exploring for the next 2 weeks ago. They announced that they were exploring about 40 new routes for Amtrak. And all of those run around freight rail right-of-ways that are owned by private operators. And so that's going to be a big problem when it comes to like seeing this done and how frequent the train and how useful the service will be, is like, are the class one railroads going to play? You know, Amtrak is like, I think behind 1,000 hours. There's about 1,000 hours of delay every year with Amtrak trains, because freight rail companies just don't want to play. They just don't have an interest in it, and they have no financial incentive to. And so it's a real problem to have them play with, you know, Amtrak, because there's really no interest that they see. And that's a big impediment for both Canada and America. The last thing I'll say is the Sunset Limited, which used to connect Florida through Texas, through Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, then the kind of the Gulf states, it ended during Hurricane Katrina because of the damage that Hurricane Katrina dealt with. And they haven't seen the Sunset Limited come back. And I think Katrina was in 2005, so 18 years ago, they still haven't had this rail to come back. And when Amtrak wanted it to come back with, I think, a train a day, the freight rail providers said it would cost like $1 billion or $2 billion for that to happen. And it was like, they were running on the tracks 15 years. what? They're like, oh no, we need to do all this work. You need to pay us all this money. And like, but what do you need to do? And the one thing that I think Pete Buttigieg and Amtrak did that I thought was masterful was that they put out a video, a live feed for people to watch the trains. And they said, we can't, apparently they need $2 billion to accommodate one Amtrak train a day. And they're like, do you think it's busy? And they put out a live camera in Louisiana all day. And it had thousands of people watching it. And they were like, oh, let's see how busy it is. And like one train came by a day. And so they just don't want to play.
Eminent domain. Time to throw some weight around.
Yep.
So we're out of time.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. I really appreciate this.
We really appreciate your time. Much appreciated. It was great talking with you. And we'll cross paths with you hopefully many times in the future.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Commute podcast from Boldin Networks. Follow or subscribe on the platform of your choice to stay connected and keep up to date with the latest innovations at boldin.com.